The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers charges U.S. dollar margin loan rates from 0.75% to 1.59%. Of course, rates are subject to change. Learn more at ibkr.com/compare. And this episode is also supported by Our Crowd. Our Crowd helps you invest early in pre-IPO companies alongside professional venture capitalists. If you're interested in investing, you need to join Our Crowd for free at OurCrowd.com/TDI.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Wrecking the house. Social justice and financial equity for all. Markets take a hit as a crowd-driven squeeze causes mayhem. No bubble here, says Powell. And our guest today, Ross Gerber, CEO of Gerber Kawasaki, breaking down the GameStop craziness and providing insights on EV trends. All this and much more on episode number 699 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. What an exhausting week. I mean, it feels like it's not 7 days. It feels like 30 days have elapsed since the last time we talked. I mean, incredible activity. And let's admit, it has been absolutely fascinating. I mean, the stuff that's going on right now, you know there's going to be courses taught about what's going on here. Anyway, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm a host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, also founder of Horowitz & Company, an investment advisory firm. Been doing this for the better part of three decades or more. And I got to tell you something, I have never seen anything this extreme. Yeah, there's been other times. I mean, there's definitely, when I start thinking back on all the different crazy items that we've seen in the past, the Tilray moves, the iOmega, the dot-com bubbles, all of those. Yeah, there's kind of those times that markets got loopy or pear-shaped, right? But it's kind of different this time, as there's this rabid crowd that's seemingly purposely trying to break the system. You know, for a long time, I've been talking about my thoughts and my reservations about this free trading and the gamification of investing and the concerns I had about this, specifically related to Robinhood and the trading app and how they do things with the free trade, but not really free, where they're actually paying or someone's paying for order flow and the order flow is going through different companies and the concerns I had about that. But this goes much deeper because in the end, I really think this is all about greed. It's a stampede of greed that's unfortunately wrapped in some kind of social justice wrapper where we're going to go from inequity financially to equity by breaking down and burning down the house. We talked about this on DH Unplugged. I did that last week. And I'm sure we're going to be getting into this with our guest today. And I'm sure we're going to be getting into this next week, continuing the discussion with next week's guest, Anthony Pompliano. I'm sure of this because this is not ending so quickly. The idea that we're doing this to get back at the unfairness that has gone on for so long is an entirely different mission than just trying to make money. And even though I think at the end of the day, it's all about making money, I really do. Even if you're thinking, no, that's not what this is. No. I'm doing this because look at these horrible hedge funds that have been just, you know, skimming off our back for years. I get that. I understand that. Yes, I'm not marginalizing that point, but really, come on. In GameStop? In Build-A-Bear? In BlackBerry? In AMC? In COS? I mean, really? And to be clear, listen, let's kind of be clear about this. If you're trading, if you're participating and understanding the risks, I'm all for it. Have at it. I have no objection. I have no problem with this at all. But understand where the risk lies in all of this and where this is going to. Is GameStop going to be the next, you know, trillion-dollar company? And if it is, what does that mean? But if you're playing along to burn down the house, you know, like rioters who get upset about something that goes on wherever they live, and they purposely burn down their own homes, is that what is really trying to be done here? Burn down the financial system for what? It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help the 401k programs. It doesn't help long-term stability of financial markets. Do we want everybody just to be wrecked? Or do we want everybody to enjoy opportunity? That's a whole different discussion. So I really think that if you are in fact thinking that this system needs to be burnt down like immediately somehow, and that's why you're buying GameStop, I would ask you respectfully to take a breath, stop just for a moment, take a pause, and look at what the goals are here and how do you think it's going to get to that point by 5 or 10 different stocks being ramped up and hurting a handful of hedge funds. There's a lot of things that are going on here that are you really need to think about, right? Because the issues that are brought up about this in terms of things like legality of the mob action and even the brokers halting some trades. I mean, there's a lot of questions that have to be answered here. It's going to take a while to wash this all out. And I'm not taking a side because I'll tell you something. This idea that there's sides in this, you know, this side versus that side, the retail versus the broker, the broker and the institutions, the hedge funds against the retail. I don't think there's any sides here. I know we like to have these sides and this drama, but I just don't get it. I don't understand where we are that we have to have this kind of incredible amount of dislocation, and then also the sides drawn up constantly. And if you think that the Reddit forums are only retail, the little guy that has been promoting this whole idea, I think you better rethink what's going on. I will be absolutely surprised if there aren't any major players pulling the strings here. It seems to me that there is a lot of this going on. Again, we're going to talk about this a little bit more, but I think that it's all about, at the end of the day, when we break it all down and just see what it is for what it is, it's all about greed that, yeah, let's get on the bandwagon and make money. And if we're going to start promoting that, it's all about, you know, changing the world, but at the same time, I can make a lot of money doing it. Hey, why not? Same thing for retail, same thing for institutions, and everyone in between this whole thing. So let's put a little pin on that. Let's hold it to the side for a second. We'll get back to that. Let's talk a little bit about markets for a second, because there's more going on. You wouldn't know it, but there's more going on. We saw some major technology companies roll out with earnings, and generally speaking, a lot of stocks have been priced for perfection. There has been an incredible rally over the last several months with the thought that we're going to see earnings continue to move up and then pricing them according to a very low interest rate environment, keeping the multiples very high. And what we saw was when the banks rolled out, that there was a significant amount of, well, okay, earnings are okay, not as what we expected. And that big run-up we saw of that last couple of months, well, maybe we'll take some profit. Same thing happened this week with regard to technology. Now, there's some other things probably happening in the markets that are pushing and pulling and why some of the most liquid names are getting sold, maybe to cover some of the losses in some of the other areas. But okay, generally speaking, it was also a sell the news event when many of these companies came out with earnings that were, in fact, priced for perfection, the absolute best possible notion of sales and earnings. And well, maybe it's just enough. So there was a little bit of a trace back on some of that. You know, markets were down, what, 3% for the week, one of the worst weeks in a while. But nonetheless, nothing too terrible. The question is going to be how much of this is going to continue forward, considering that we have a bit of inflation through PCE and CPI, and we have the concern about the direction of the pandemic and the concern about, how effective is the vaccine and what can we do from there? And then, of course, can we get this vaccine out there? That's a big issue also that's coming up. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the next week. I mean, the Fed is still on board in a big way and plenty of overall liquidity in the markets. But, even though we're seeing some concerning news about the pandemic, so far, the markets, the investor out there has been able to compartmentalize the temporary condition, which it seems like it's permanent now, but the quote-unquote temporary condition of the pandemic, and then eventually we're going to get out of this. So we have a lot to talk about, a lot to talk about with our guest, so we're going to give it plenty of time. Before we do that, I want to take a quick break. You remember last week we had Steve Sanders on, and he was the executive vice president of Interactive Brokers, and we talked about a lot of things, but one of the things we really focused on was margin, and we talked about the many uses of margin. I wanted to remind you that Interactive Brokers charges margin loan rates from 0.75% to 1.59%. Of course, rates can change, but their clients can also earn extra income by lending their fully paid shares of stock. And that's a good thing because you get some opportunity there for stocks that you're just holding in your account. So you could join Interactive Brokers clients from more than 200 countries and territories to invest in stocks. And they have options and futures and funds and bonds on a global basis. You have the opportunity to minimize your costs, which is important, of course, and maximize your returns. That's the formula. Learn more at ibkr.com/compare. Now, I also wanted to bring back the discussion about what many investors are thinking about these days. That is how to get in early on some of the biggest potential opportunities that are available for the future. Because a lot of people have wished that, you get in early on some of these really incredible IPOs that we saw in 2019 and 2020. Well, our crowd investors did, and now you can join them in what's next. With our crowd, accredited investors have access to invest directly, easily, and most importantly, early. Our crowd investors have benefited from our crowd companies IPOing, like Beyond Meat and Lemonade, or being bought by companies like Intel or Nike, Microsoft, and Oracle. So if you're an accredited investor, you can join our crowd for free at ourcrowd.com/TDI and review the current deals. No payment is involved until you decide to participate in a deal. And today you can join our crowd's investment in NanoLock Security, a company offering IoT, which is Internet of Things, cyber protection, including billions of low-end devices and other technologies that can't usually be protected. NanoLock is the only device-level protection that has near-zero power requirements and is agnostic to the operating system. You can get in early on NanoLock and other unique opportunities at ourcrowd.com/TDI. That's ourcrowd, ourcrowd.com/TDI. Don't forget, the Our Crowd account is free, so check it out. ourcrowd.com/TDI. So as I promised, we're going to do a deep dive. Let's get to our guest right now. And our guest today is Ross Gerber. He's the co-founder and president and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He oversees the Gerber Kawasaki's corporate and investment management operations, as well as serves individual clients. He's created some really interesting apps for helping people with their financial futures and security. And plus, he's an expert on the area of Tesla and EVs. Hey, what's going on? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. There's a lot of moving parts to the markets right now. I mean, to say the least, right? Just when you thought it wasn't that interesting.
Well, I never thought it wasn't that interesting. I mean, I'm a guy who's been doing this since I was a kid. So, from my perspective, I'm really excited that other people are actually interested in it.
Yeah, it is. It's been really kind of fascinating, the amount of interest that is, which is kind of bizarre in the most recent downturn of markets and then, you know, the pandemic. And it seems like a lot of people are really trying to get better educated and understand and get involved.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you would have told me a pandemic was going to get people to pay attention to the stock market, I wouldn't have put those two together normally. Yeah. Because I actually at the time thought we were going to go through a very, very difficult economic time, which it turns out we are. But for some reason, people have money during this very difficult economic time. And what we determined after a lot of research was that the pain is really being felt by actually a small amount of people who are feeling a lot of pain, where the vast majority of the population is actually just doing fine and working from home or whatever they're doing, and they're getting these stimulus checks and they're saving their money because they're not going to restaurants and concerts, and they decided to become investors, I think, just to make extra money or keep themselves busy when sports were shut down, and now it's turned into a full-fledged obsession.
Yeah. Kind of amazing. What's your feeling on the markets right now with in terms of where we are? Very broad brush discussion of valuations, this whole narrative that low rates can support valuations and, you know, all the fiscal and monetary, and there's a bull case for that. What's your kind of thoughts on this?
So I constantly think markets evolve, and I think one of the reasons a lot of investors haven't profited in the last 5 years is their inability to evolve their thinking, because, you know, things change a lot over the 30 years I've been doing this. And the way I thought about things 20 years ago or 10 years ago isn't the way I think about them today. So one of the things that's changed is this concept of inflation and monetary policy, where there was this idea that you had interest rates that would offset inflation and therefore create, you know, sort of a stable flow of monetary printing that was, you know, usually about 2-4%, you know, of the printing rate, or whatever you want to call it, inflation rate. And now we've gotten to a point where we can print really like 20% more money, which would imply like 20% inflation, and still have no inflation and have to pay no interest to print that money. So the government's now taken to a policy where we just print money essentially to pay for things and to give people money. And as long as there's not a repercussion, then yeah, valuations can be stretched like they are and continue to grow, because essentially being an American doesn't cost anything in the global world because money's free for us. If you buy that, though, I think you're going to end up broke or dead. You know what I mean? So I don't actually buy that, even though that's what's happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm playing the game the hands I've been dealt, and quite frankly, playing them quite well. But by no means do I think this works long term as a real monetary system.
I mean, you're talking about the idea that MMT is going to be taking over, where we could basically, I mean,
yeah.
Why do we have to pay taxes under that scenario?
Why do we have to do anything, right? We just print money. Like, why would you even pay taxes? Like, it seems stupid to take money from people. You're just going to give it back to them, right?
Exactly.
So this assumes that we're in a world where people will just keep giving us money because we're the best, you know, party in town. But what happens eventually is the inflation will come. And despite the fact that everybody in the world thinks inflation's dead, that makes me even more concerned, because now we've got pent up demand, pent up dollars, printed dollars, and when they open these floodgates, I mean, you know how much it's going to cost to go to a concert next year?
Oh yeah.
Do you know how much it's going to cost to go on a European vacation next year? It's going to be 30-40% higher for 100 reasons. So the cost of living is going to dramatically increase. We're seeing that with housing, for example, right now. So here we are, renters can't pay, mortgages can't pay, but home prices are going up.
Yep. As a matter of fact, we saw the greatest increase in the Case-Shiller this week at, I think, 9.8% on the 20-city year over year.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was just looking at something. So this guy Shamath called me an idiot the other day because I was trying to explain, not to him, that if you print 10% more money and your stock market goes up 13%, in essence, it didn't go up.
Right. Okay? Venezuela.
Right. You had inflation plus money printing. So, like, if you – and what I had said was that if you look at the stock market in gold terms, it was actually a down year. And he was like, what the fuck are you talking about, you idiot? And I was like, no, actually, I know you're a very smart guy, but maybe this even went beyond your head. Okay? The government just can't print money and say, look, my asset went up in value, when really all that happened is I have more dollars to chasing that asset, you know? Yep. And that's housing today, where people can't pay rent, but real estate's going up. Okay? Well, that makes no sense. Well, it's because we just print more dollars. Real estate actually hasn't gone up at all. What's happened is the dollar's gone down.
Right. So that's looking at it from a different – now, what you're doing is looking at it from a different aspect. You're looking at it in a relationship versus –
right. Like if I'm a global investor who travels throughout the world and uses every different type of currency, is in theory, you know, I can look at my money in dollar terms and say I had a great year, or I can look at my money in Swiss franc terms and it sucks.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, it's just, you know, that's what I said, my Swiss friends, I'm like, how was your year? Oh, it sucked. Well, our currency is too strong.
Right.
You know, I go, well, that's because you guys have a real currency.
Right.
God, why? What's wrong with you Swiss people with your gold and a real currency?
Right. You got you real know, backing.
Like, just print. If you just print, give it to everybody in Switzerland, they're all feeling richer and nobody's going to care.
Yeah.
It is kind of a weird thing that we've gotten to this point because, you know, we look at other economies around the world, like Japan, who kind of was the poster child of the idea of very low interest rates, trying to increase inflation, never doing it, and then constantly, you know, getting a relatively muted growth over time, and then continuing the same process, trying even crazy things like negative interest rates, and
right,
I mean, just
and they've created the worst economy in the world.
The worst.
They've created the worst economy.
Right.
It's the worst.
And we
you know why?
Follow along.
Because they just don't have enough sex, you know, and they don't have babies, and they don't allow immigrants. And so if you don't allow immigrants and you don't allow sex, well, what do you get? You get a shitty economy, and that's Japan. You know, so you can print money, you can give it to people, you can borrow money. I heard they were just trying to get people to have babies, you know? Yeah. There's towns in Japan that have no babies.
There was a really fascinating study many years ago by a couple of different guys, but on the whole idea of demographic economics and the whole thought of, hey, what's going on in Japan? Really, it's all about the aging population and what's happening. You know, what's happening here and the same thing. And
absolutely.
So the bull case I get, you know, kind of like money printing, great earnings, opportunities. Where's the bear case? It's the inflation.
Yeah, absolutely. The bear case is the inflation and the interest rate problem that will eventually happen.
Yeah.
So what happens is everybody's living this really dreamy life where we can print money and give it to people and everybody's happy and we solve Corona and we're all out partying in Vegas and we can't get a room because it costs $600 a night. And then all of a sudden we want to take a flight and it costs $600 a flight. And all of a sudden we want to buy food and it costs $600 for pizza. And it's like, wow, everything's expensive now. Everything's expensive. So then the Fed raises rates, and the minute they even do one little thing, the minute they even taper one little dollar from the treasuries, what do you think happens?
Yeah,
panic. It all goes the other direction.
Yeah, panic. So what do you do to guard against inflation? I mean, you mentioned gold. Are you also doing cryptos?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I don't like to say cryptos because the only cryptocurrency I play with is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the hedge against this ridiculous system that they've created. So while the governments have created a system that self-benefits them at the expense of society, crypto went around after the financial crisis. It was created because of the financial crisis because a bunch of tech guys said, maybe we can just build a better system they can't, you know, continually print money with. So we'll just make it so there's 21 million Bitcoin and it's an algorithm and it's decentralized and no government can control it. What a great idea if they can make this work. And over all the attacks and years, they've made it work. I've been involved with Bitcoin for about 5 years or so, maybe, and it's gone from $250 to, you know, $32,000 in the time that I've been involved. I wish I was more involved back then, but I thought it was pretty shady at the time.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. I have one question about this, though. Do you look at Bitcoin as a hedge slash investment, or do you look at it as an alternative currency and a store of value? Because this is where I have a big problem. I have no problem as an investment. I have no problem. Even as a hedge, if you will.
It's not an investment in the traditional sense, like a stock where you're buying into a company.
Yeah.
You know, like, so Bitcoin's not a company. So like, that's why I it's hard for me to look at it like a traditional investment, even though I'm treating it as an investment,
right?
Like I'm treating it as an investment in a tech idea. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like, I've tried to use Bitcoin. When I first started with Bitcoin, I was like, is this a store of value or is this an investment? And I tried using Bitcoin. That's actually one of my favorite stories, is the computer in my kid's room I bought for 3 Bitcoin, which at the time was $750.
Oh, that's an expensive computer now.
$120,000 Dell, NVIDIA chip. But Dell and NVIDIA were the only two companies that would take Bitcoin. And I wanted to see if I could actually buy things with Bitcoin. And I was able to do that, although it wasn't very efficient. And I think Bitcoin has still yet to prove any utility. And I challenge my Bitcoin friends all the time to create utility out of Bitcoin. And the person that's done it, which caused the rally, it started with PayPal, but it's really Square. Mm-hmm. So Square has the best opportunity to make Bitcoin an actual monetary system, because they have merchants, they have now Bitcoin on their platform, and they can put the whole platform together top to bottom, which is what I think Square's trying to do. Is Bitcoin an efficient place to buy and sell from as far as for a currency? No, absolutely not. But it's because it's so immature. It's not that it won't be in the future. But the volatility is based off immaturity, just like an IPO. So I think Bitcoin is both an investment. I don't look at it as a store of value.
Okay, we're on the same page with that, right?
Right. There's no value being stored. The value of Bitcoin is in the value of the network. So the bigger the network, the more people who use it, the more people who compute with the hash rate, you know, the more players in the game, the more value it has. The less players, the less value. So as more people adopt Bitcoin, the more valuable it becomes. But I don't look at it like gold, which it is a store of value, because for 5,000 years, the same three, you know, swimming pools worth of gold has always been money, you know?
Right.
So I own gold too, but I own a lot more Bitcoin than I own gold, to be honest. And I think over the long term, I think Bitcoin will become a more used currency because of government, you know, I would say irresponsibility more than anything else.
So how are you doing that for clients?
Well, right now,
it's difficult.
Haven't done anything for clients.
Right. It's impossible.
Of a lot of reasons. But we are about to, and I don't want to like, you know, say we're doing it yet because we haven't signed the actual paperwork, but we're about to start using Gemini. You know, we were really impressed with the people involved and the fact that they could secure our Bitcoin. So we're going to have insurance on we're going to have 2 layers of insurance on our Bitcoin accounts. So, and clients won't be able to trade it. So a client will be controlling the Bitcoin for the client so that they can't do stupid stuff. And we think it should be an allocation for investors of it. You know, I think ARK just said the same thing we've been saying, anywhere from 1-5% of your portfolio, depending on your age and risk tolerance. But, you know, probably it's a good 2% position for somebody, just like buying a tech stock, and you put it in your back pocket like gold, and hopefully it'll gain value as more and more people adopt it, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, the Grayscale, the ETF, it just is very inefficient. It usually, right now, it doesn't have had ridiculous premiums on it. Gemini's, isn't that Winklevoss?
Yeah.
Winklevi.
So the Gemini people really have their act together. Like, they understand what investors really want out of Bitcoin. And that's why I think they're going to be successful, because they understand the issues that unsophisticated tech people aren't able to secure their Bitcoin correctly. It's a really hard thing to secure your Bitcoin, and it doesn't have investor protections that other assets do. So that's the biggest risk. I've been attacked and hacked and all the problems that, you know, people trying to take over my phone and all this. It's a nightmare. So, you know, like, to put $100,000 into Bitcoin to me is stupid, because you just like can't protect it. So by the Gemini people, really, by creating levels of protection, I think it really, how would I say it? It creates the ability for an advisor, right, to make a recommendation that you won't regret because of an error that some client makes because they don't know how to use their phone right. or something. You know?
I've always had that panic attack. Like, what if I lose my passwords? Or for example, recently, so I have a little Bitcoin account, and I'm like, wait a minute, I just changed phones, and my authenticator no longer has that information in it. And I'm like, what do I do with that?
Yeah.
You know? So let's switch over to EVs. I know it's an area you love talking about. You're a big Tesla bull, been that way for a long time. Recently, we had earnings just a couple of days ago on Tesla, and a little bit of a miss, no big deal, but, you know, kind of a very fluid market. One of the things that I thought, I know you're a big fan, but this reconciliation that Elon did during the conference call, something to the do with the effect of, hey, the valuation is reasonable because if we take a ramp up of production, then if we add robo taxis and we kind of have a high margin on those and blah, 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 you know, $1 trillion. That was the answer at the end of the thing, I think, something like that, right? Do you think that's reasonable?
I don't think you got the quote like quite right. You know, what he said is you should look at the value of Tesla as the amount of potential cell production capability plus the value of the full self-driving software. Okay. And what he's saying is a deeper thing. And what it really means is that for electric vehicles to be successful, and this is an area we're investing in dramatically right now outside of Tesla, is in cell battery production. So the EV business, whether you're, you know, GM or Fisker or Volkswagen, it all relies around the fundamental power that's generated through the battery packs, through the cells. And there's been cell constraint now for some time with Tesla using a ton of cells and ramping production. So now that Tesla's ramped production, they ran out of cells, so they invented their own, and they're building their own cell factories right now. Mm-hmm. So essentially, EV growth can only be measured by how many battery packs that can be made globally from every player, more than by measuring potential demand. So demand for EVs is unlimited. So let's just assume for the sake of ease that you could buy EVs forever. Everybody wants one, okay? Mm-hmm. But the reality is the supply, right? Like Tesla struggled to get to 500,000, okay? Right. Like it was no easy path. Right. I can tell you that firsthand. It was incredibly difficult to scale Tesla. And they finally broke the code and they got it, and now they're scaling and they still haven't done many of the things they're trying to do. You know, right. It's never been done. So the point is that, and what we're buying are cell producers like Panasonic and CATL and LG Chem, because essentially Tesla's going to take every cell they can get, and every other company is going to take every cell they can get, and that's the end of the business. So if you're going to value Tesla, you have to look at their ability to make batteries more than the cars.
And that would also make them less reliant on the other parties.
Right.
Yeah.
It actually corners the market on really high quality cells, because what Tesla did was they built a 7 times better cell, and now they're in productions with these new cells, which are going to lower the cost and increase the performance of the cars. And they're going to still take the old cells. And basically he was saying, I'm going to take every cell I can, because essentially we cannot meet the demand.
I mean, we're seeing a lot of, news items. Listen, over the last week, right? President Biden says that he wants to convert the entire U.S. fleet of cars that the federal government uses, about, I think it's 650,000 or so, to electric. So that was a big bump, right? Is Tesla going to be involved in that? Big.
But you also have to keep into consideration, it can't be done.
Right.
Okay. I asked Elon this question at Battery Day, and I said, Elon, and it was on TV, and I said, you know, like, if everything Tesla does works, is this really going to have a dent in climate change? And the answer was basically no. He was like, the purpose of Tesla was to force the advent of sustainable transportation. It wasn't to solve climate change.
Right.
Tesla is just the tip of the sword of what needs to be done. And so there, you know, like this is the huge issue. Like, how is Biden going to get 650,000 new EV cars? You know, Tesla's finally up to 500. I mean, what's the global production of EV cars right now? You know, is it 1 million a year even, you know? And so, like, you know, this is a growth business, though. You know, like, this is amazing. So that's what he means about the valuation. So we've got to look at what's the total amount of cells with Giga Berlin and Giga Texas coming online. Like, how many batteries can they make a year? Because that's all that matters, okay? And also, they use it for storage, too. And then the second side is the value of the full self-driving software. So if the concept that the physical making of a car has no value, it's kind of like a mall. Like anybody can make a car. Like when I went to Tesla and I went through the assembly line, that's the easiest part of the process.
Okay.
The hardest part of the process, and that's why they're bad at it, actually. The irony is that they're bad at the easy part and they're amazing at the good, at the hard part, because that's all they focus on is the hard part.
Right.
And, you know, it was like, oh, that's shit. We got to make good paint. You know what I mean? Well, you know, you got to make good paint, Elon. It's still a fucking car, you know? And that's the part they had to learn, you know, right. They're still learning. But that's the mentality of tech people, because the technology is what's valuable in their mind, not the actual paint. You know, they're like, oh, he cares about the paint. Yeah. I care about the paint.
So do you think that the announcement today or this week by GM that they said, which I thought was fascinating, I mean, or ridiculous, I should say ridiculous, that they are going to have an exclusive offering of EVs by 2035 and be carbon neutral totally by 2040. I think there was something like that. 2035. We're talking about 15 years.
Yeah. I hope to be alive.
I mean,
I hope to be alive.
That's unbelievable that it would take that long to start converting. And of course, the stock goes up because anything that's, you know, talked about like that. What are the other names, though? Are there anybody else? I mean, Fisker is a dead company. It's coming back to life through a SPAC.
No, it's going to stay dead.
Yeah, Canoe is kind of interesting. What about?
Probably the worst company I've seen of them all.
Canoe. I looked at Workhorse. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I don't know them very well. So there's two companies that I really like in this space. One is actually Lucid. I spent time
with beautiful car.
A wonderful car.
Yeah.
But it's not about the car. It's about the people behind the car who actually know how to make one. Okay. Yeah. So that's a big deal. They know how to make batteries and they know how to make cars. And they've done all the work on the Formula E batteries. So they have this expertise on high performance batteries, which gives them an edge on production and efficiency. They know how to build cars. Their DNA is car building. So unlike Tesla, they start with car builders, you know, and like German car builders. So I have a feeling they're going to come out with a great car. I think they're going to, it'll hold up. It's going to be beautiful. It'll be expensive. And I think they'll be successful. So I think Lucid is a great company. And the company I'm actually meeting with today is Acrimoto, which makes low-end EVs, really, in my mind, to solve the last mile solution for Uber drivers, delivery package. You know, Amazon is the biggest polluter in the world.
They use Rivian, right?
Well, that's the theory that they're going to use Rivian. They invested in Rivian. But Rivian has the same problem that I brought up, which is where are they going to get their cells from? You know, so if everybody's saying they're going to make 100,000 cars a year, well, where are they getting their cells from? So, and everybody's trying to build their EVs with Magna. You know, that's like the Fisker thing. Well, how's Magna? Magna makes like 1% of their cars are EVs. Now they're going to go to 20%. You know, like, are they that good at it? You know, so everybody's relying on outsourcing all these things. And that's why Tesla's not doing that, because they know there's not going to be enough supply. So I think that's Rivian's problem. I think they make a great looking truck. But once again, I made this joke the other day. I'm going to release my own EV. I'm going to call it the Llama. And, you know, and I can draw the coolest looking car ever and say I'm going to produce it. But it doesn't mean anything. It's not about the fucking car.
Yeah, I mean, just think about Nikola.
Right.
I mean, that was something. What about the charging stations? I mean, there's a couple of, aside from Tesla, there's Blink, there's SBE. Any of those that look interesting?
Well, at first I was really bullish on the idea of investing in charging stations until I looked into it. And then I became very bearish on the idea. So you know how gas stations make money, right? They make money selling Gatorade and candy bars. You know? And that's basically the idea of a charging station. So a concept of putting in a charging station, charging $1 a minute, you make 50 cents a minute, you know, or $1 an hour is what they charge. You make 50 cents an hour. You know, you start doing the math on this stuff and it's not attractive, right?
Yeah.
If every stall is filled in every place in the country, 8 hours a day, how much do I make? It's not attractive. But I think if you're smart about charging stations and open like what Tesla did with like Kettleman City on the road between LA and San Francisco. So the Kettleman City supercharger is like, there's a little gift shop and food and a coffee shop and merch, and you go in there, like you got to stop. Everybody's got to stop when they're driving after 2-3 hours of driving, go pee, walk or whatever. And so I think there's money in building a platform around charging that includes other services.
Right. So have like either a dedicated food truck stop somewhere, or have a Wawa, or have a Cumberland Farms. Right. Or so. Yeah, that's what you have to do. I agree.
Absolutely. Right. So I think there's money in developing like charging station platform, like where you would buy, let's say, like an old gas station and convert it into a charging station, but then put like a cool restaurant and merch and other stuff. And I think Tesla's done a good job of it in some of their charging stations. So like, I think the model exists, but I think the idea of just dotting the countryside with chargers and hoping that I make money, it's not for me.
Or the alternative is taking these charging stations and retrofitting some of the gas stations with them, and then having those as the producers of them. You know what I mean? Just like what Altria had.
Yeah, but even still, the gas station is still a bad business, you know.
I get it, but I'm saying it can at least have less bad.
Well, I look at it more from a restaurant perspective.
Right. No, I'm saying because you need time.
I would open a restaurant and put Tesla chargers there, and you got a fan base coming in every minute, you know?
Yeah. I get it. Let's switch real quickly before we end. What's going on in the crazy world of short squeezes? obviously, it's been kind of a whirlwind. The idea that, hey, David and Goliath, and you know what? The man is going down. Hedge funds, screw them. The little guy is finally going to win. Let me just kind of frame this for you. Here's the idea, right? The whole idea is, you know what? You know what? The street's been screwing us for years and years and years, and we're finally going to get back at them. Now, who are these players that are saying this? This is the people who opened up an account 6 months ago. They put in some money into their Robinhood, into their Charles Schwab account, TD Ameritrade, whatever it is. And what screwing have they gotten? They've been just doing this for a few months.
They're not going to want to know the truth, is they're all just screwing each other, right?
Right.
Well. So, you know, with every buy, there's a sell, and it's not like Robinhood traders are trading with hedge funds. They're trading between themselves probably 90% of the time, right? Mm-hmm. So that fallacy should be immediately debunked. I think this is a bigger thing. It's sort of the Trump thing too, with the populism and the F you to the system thing. And certainly, you know, I'm not a populist, but I'm an anti-establishment person actually, but I'm mostly from the hippie perspective. You know, I'm a Grateful Dead fan kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been anti-establishment more than a populist, but I think what it is, and there's some truth to the fact that hedge funds have certainly played a game where they manipulate markets and do what they need to do to make money. There's shows about it. I just dealt with it with Tesla for 2 years of being attacked. I just got a tweet that they put Gordon Johnson back on CNBC to bash Tesla's earnings. CNBC won't put me on now to talk about Tesla because I kill their guests, and they just like won't have it because they have to protect their bears, you know? So this game has gone on forever. And so actually it was another institution, Ryan Cohen, the guys from Chewy, who bought GameStop, and they bought 12% of GameStop for $75 million. And they were the ones who came up with the idea to squeeze the shorts. It was not people on Wall Street bets. Okay. Once the stock got moving, the chatter box started going. I think that was a concerted effort by the same people. Okay.
Well,
hedge fund game for the hedge funds too.
Right. So Ross, here's the problem. The thought is that it was the quote unquote little guy on Reddit and on this Wall Street Bet site. And it was the idea that these were the ones that were promoting all this, but we really don't know the anonymous accounts, the PR teams,
right,
the hedge funds that are behind it, and this whole fallacy that's being the narrative that's being created in the news about this is all an attack. It can't be. It's just too big.
Listen. I've done this for my whole life. I can't talk about all the methods that people use to make money in the stock market today through manipulating social media. Okay. It started with the Trump people and winning the election, and it's been going on since people figured this out. I have been on the other side of it, and then I figured out how to do it myself. Now, I don't use these methods because I don't think they're ethical, but I certainly use it to defend myself. And I've been on the other side of attacks constantly over Tesla. Okay. And we developed countermeasures to these attacks. So to think that the Wall Street Bets people don't get that they're just being manipulated by other hedge funds who are long trying to make money here, like Ryan Cohen's fund or whatever, like they're wrong too. But it doesn't matter. See, none of that matters. All that matters in their mind is they were able to buy $5,000 of options, turn it into 25 grand in three nights, and they think that that's their right to just take ridiculous speculative risks on stock, on worthless stocks that are being manipulated by different hedge funds for profit.
So it's not social justice is what you're telling me. I thought this is all about, you know, moving this right to Main Street from Wall Street. That's not what it's about.
Well, look, I mean, I'm an institution, not on Wall Street, but I'm an institution. And I manage like $1.6 billion. And I can look at stocks that are worth $100 million and I can do whatever I want with those things because I could buy the whole company. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
There's a lot of rules to the game that you're supposed to follow, and I do. There's a lot of people who don't, and they play all these games. There's shows about it. I mean, Billions was, I thought, a great show.
Great show.
And it showed any of the techniques that hedge funds use to make money. We know Stephen Cohen just bought the Mets. He bought the Mets with money he made through what I would call questionable trading techniques. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I look, the guy went through the SEC. I'm not going to say he's a crook or not a crook. Is it completely questionable what he does? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. He invented the game. But the social justice angle of it is what people want to hear. See, like, there's a lot of people who feel slighted by capitalism or our system for a lot of legitimate reasons, okay? And yeah. And they and what Trump sold them was that he was going to be the guy that you know evened it out for them. And of course that didn't come true. And it's the same idea with this. Like if we go beat up on a bunch of short selling hedge funds, we're somehow, this is social equity. Well, it's not, because there's hedge funds that are long and there's hedge funds that are short these same stocks. And, you know, they're just being whipped around in a game that's much bigger than them. You know,
I think it's also beyond Trump and all that. It's also that we've gotten to a point where it's people believe it's their right, as you mentioned, to make money. And everybody should participate in this because that's what we get. We get free money. We get trophies for participation. You know, everybody should just get it. And this has been going on totally much longer.
Exactly what you're saying. And I tweeted that this morning and people were shocked. I go, what makes you think it's your right? I go, there's actually rules to this game.
Yep.
And one of the rules is that you're not allowed to open a margin option account for somebody who's 23 years old with no investment experience and $4,000 in the account.
Yeah.
It's actually, that's the rule. The only rules that are violated are the fact they let these people trade options, because that's actually not legal. Okay. So Robinhood is the problem. It's not the markets.
But why is nobody doing anything about this? It's been progressing.
The SEC under Trump hasn't done anything. Wow. SEC, actually, that's not true. The SEC just busted Robinhood for making false claims that it's free trades when it's not free trades, and fined them $60 million, which is a huge number. You know, which would put a lot of people out of business, and they just did another capital raise. That's what they did. Oh, we'll just do another capital raise. And so Robinhood is the problem. Robinhood should be shut down. There are rules to the game. This isn't just a free market. I was trying to explain this to people. You know how many rules I have to follow?
I know. I'm regulated up myself. Speaking of which, you're in California. And I'm in Florida. So we are in opposite ends of the world in coronavirusville. Down here, everything goes.
Really?
It's like nothing's happening.
Oh, right. Like, you guys can go out and I can't.
Yeah, I mean, here it's not only go, you're encouraged. It's you know, it's wear a mask as you stand and as you sit, no problem. If you go into somewhere, you take it off once you kind of pass through. But basically everything is open down here. Our governor just requested a move of the Olympics for 2021, what looks like it could be canceled in Japan, and moved to Florida for this year. I mean, like, how does that even happen? How is it in California these days?
Well, you know, there's a lot of misperception because of the media. California's a huge state. I live in West LA, and I live in one of the, you know, I mean this well, I live in one of the nicest areas in the country. And obviously the way we live here, everything's fine, you know, other than I can't eat outside. But no, there's no parties and there's no bars. But like, you know, like, everything's pretty normal here for the most part. And you know, coronavirus is a real thing. The people of Florida are dying just as much as they are here.
I get it.
You know, ironically, I just got off the phone with a friend of mine who got corona, and he was really sick for 2 months. And, you know, I have two employees who got corona, and they were young, and they didn't get too sick. And, you know, I've heard a lot of different stories. And
I had it back in Father's Day. Yeah. And it was like, it was not much, to be honest, for me.
I've heard a lot of different stories, and none of them are the same, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, like, I know certainly that I think if I got corona, I would live. I don't think I'm going to live, but I also don't want to be sick for 2 months or whatever. I don't even care. I don't want it, you know, to get it.
Right.
So people are really concerned about health in California. So, like, people don't want, like, regular germs, let alone corona. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, you know, now the other parts of LA, like downtown or South LA, where, you know, the more humans live, we have high density. We have a lot of jobs that are, you know, manufacturing, and we're seeing a huge, huge toll on, you know, unfortunately, the poorer people in our community. Yeah. And
that's a problem.
It's a huge problem because they're being forced to work in conditions that aren't safe, and they have no choice because they need the money. And you know, a lot of companies are just profit focused, and it's very expensive to operate safely in corona. So LA, because we're big in agriculture and distribution, manufacture, we're just seeing a huge toll among the neediest of our population. Yeah. And it's really tragic what's happening. We have an obesity problem in America. So that's the other problem. You know, corona and obesity just don't mix. It's sending people to the hospital. It's causing huge problems for those people. So, you know, it's a huge toll on our economy and our society, and we have vaccines that I'm pretty confident will work. And you know, it's been botched so far, and hopefully we'll get these vaccines out to people and we'll cut the death toll. But I do think we're kind of at the worst now, and things will get better moving forward. But I think Florida versus California, in hindsight, it'll be very interesting because we'll be able to assess the real damage or not damage different policies had, or the arbitrary nature of policies. See, at least in Florida, you don't have arbitrary policies.
Right.
So if you're not going to have policies that work, just don't have them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But in California, they tried arbitrary policies. So some of the policies were meant to work, but then they didn't have other policies that would have seemed obvious. So, like, in my mind, if you let people from Florida fly to California every single day, or Texas, that we're just never going to solve corona.
Correct.
So travel is the biggest issue for corona. It's not. See, like, if nobody from South Africa comes to America, we don't have to worry about the South African strain. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Shut it down.
Yeah.
I don't need anybody from South Africa here right now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what the successful countries have done, whether it's Thailand or Australia or New Zealand, is they just shut the borders. They solve corona internally, and you got to go from there, and you got to fight it hard. Or the American style, which is basically just get to herd immunity through sickness and vaccine.
Yeah, crazy. Ross Gerber from Gerber Kawasaki. We're going to put all the information on how to get in touch with you over on the show notes for episode number 699 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Hey, thanks for joining me. Hopefully, when this all clears up, we can have a drink together in a normal bar.
Can't wait to visit Florida again, to be honest.
Great. Come on fishing with us.
There.
We do a lot of fishing down here.
Yeah, sounds great. I've got a lot of plans. It'll be expensive, but we've got a lot of plans.
All right. I'll see you soon. You could pay us in Bitcoin. That'd be fine.
Yeah, hopefully it'll go up.
Yeah.
And thanks for having me, Andrew.
All right, appreciate it. All right, bye.
Yeah.
Well, that was a lot of ground to cover, and thanks, Ross, for being there and spending some time with us, giving us some great insights, a lot of good information there. Of course, more information about Ross's firm, some of the stocks that we discussed today, et cetera, will be on the show notes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode 699. Lots of information to grab. We'll have more on DH Unplugged this week on Tuesday night at 9 live, or you can find it on any of your favorite podcast directories that are out there, and Spotify and Amazon Podcasts and iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. Hey, thanks for joining me. Hopefully you got a lot out of this. Let's find out what happens next week. It's going to be a lot of fun. I can tell you right now, lots of information that will be flowing, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of screaming and crowd mobs going on again about all these various stocks that have incredibly high short interest that are going to be squeezed and squozing and backed and falling and up. Can't wait. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.